This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth. Building wealth and protecting legacy since 2004. Invest better with Brenthurst.
So France is one of the country's foremost scenario planners, a man whose insights help leaders navigate the country's complex and often turbulent future. You know him as Dr. France Crunier, the analyst whose data-driven forecasts cut out the noise. But the skills that he uses to map out uncertain futures were not just honed in boardrooms. As a young man, he embarked on a year-long expedition from Cape Town to Cairo. Year-long. But like Andrew. Andrew's here. Andrew, where are you, Andrew? Okay, I've got to have a shout-out for Andrew. Those of you who've been coming to BizNews conferences for a long time may remember when Andrew, I think you were still studying at the time. He said, hey, he'd love to come to the conference in the Berg, but it's a bit expensive. So what he'll do is he'll ride his bicycle from Cape Town to the Drakensberg. Took him 7 days. And boy, did we give you a reception when you arrived there. Well done, Andrew. Lovely to see. Now he's a fully graduated entrepreneur and he didn't have to ride from Cape Town to get here. So thank you. Lovely to see you, Andrew. But a little bit like that, what France did some years ago. Before that, he'd already served in the South African police and worked as both a horse riding instructor and a lumberjack in the United States. Something you're unlikely to know about France is that he spent many hours as Clem Sunter's golf partner, spoiling a good long walk with a globally respected futurist from whom he said he learned a great deal. That experience navigating the length of the African continent and adapting to vastly different environments provided a unique real-world education in risk, strategy, and understanding how societies function on the ground, not just here in South Africa, but around the world. France has since swapped his rucksack for regression models, but the adventurous and analytical spirit remains the same. He's now, like Rob Herzhoff, a media mogul in the making. So it's exciting for us because usually at BizNews, or certainly in my career, I've been creating media moguls from within the organization. But now it's even the guys that we talk to. They go off and start media companies, which you can never have too many of them, or never have too many good ones of them, because it's all about information, isn't it? And providing balanced information to society. Please welcome a man who has mapped out territories, both physical and political, Dr. France Crunier.
Good morning. It's very nice to be back at the sort of incredible movement in the sense that you've created. I think beyond a media business, there's something else to it as well. I will, firstly, France Crunier doesn't actually get that much right. He's got the good sense to have some very brilliant colleagues. And on things like elections, I rely very heavily on the very extremely brilliant Gareth van Onselen, who is the guy, perhaps the global guy, on polling. And I kind of repeat what they tell me to say. So what happens to us now? I'm going to try and make that argument for you. I'll try and put in the Americans and why they're important. And to not keep you in suspense, those of us sitting here, regardless of the forks, which of the roots in the fork, because there'll be a fork coming, we take, it's going to work out well here. Not necessarily true for much of the rest of society. To start the argument, we start with cause and effect. So why do things happen in South Africa? And over the last 30 years, there's a pattern that stands out that's now terribly clear. And if you understand the pattern and follow it, things start to make sense. And the chain of events essentially is this: confidence. And I'll give you some numbers just now. Investor confidence. That leads to fixed investment. That leads to the economic growth number. That leads directly to the jobs and living standards number. And that leads to whatever the political numbers for the country are. So how did that work? The ANC comes to power. And investor confidence levels are relatively low. They lift initially, they get knocked back into the Asian crisis of 98. And then from about 98, late 98, 99, for a decade, investor confidence lifts strongly. And it's an index, you can measure it, and it was quite low. And it went to what's just a relative measure, 80 points, and it held there for a number of years into the late 2000s. When that happened, as the confidence number lifted, fixed investment as a share of GDP picked up from 15% of GDP, where the ANC found it when they came to power, to break through 20 and get to 21 and get to 22, and it was making its way upwards before being interrupted by various things, including the global financial crisis. When fixed investment got into the 20s, the rate of economic growth followed it, broke through 3% and then 4%, and then it broke through 5%. And what happened as a consequence of that is we as a country create about 100,000 net new jobs per year per point of GDP growth, which is a number that shouldn't necessarily hold, but it has held and continues to hold, even though the world and the structure of GDP changes. And the net effect of all of this was that the ANC in its first decade in power, just more than a decade, has doubled the number of people in employment. Mandela and Mbeki are creating 500,000 net new jobs per year by the time that Mbeki's sort of term runs out. Behind that, levels of violent protest action fell very quickly. About 20% of protests were violent in 94. That bottomed out 6% in 2008. And ANC support that had started out in 94 at 63% is 6 points stronger. They're at 70% in 2004. After 2008, the financial crisis, running out of electricity, the beginning of the Zuma era, all of that comes together and the trend lines reverse completely. Investor confidence that had held at this 80 points mark on the index falls immediately to 40 points and stays there. Fixed investment levels fall from 22% of GDP back to 15% and stay there, really into the present. This week's data was even a bit below that. And that's an astonishing number because our emerging market peers average fixed investment levels of 25 to 30% of GDP. When that happened, net job creation ended. Whereas there'd been 14 or 15 million people in employment in 2008, today the number is 17 million. Compare that to the first decade, first 12, 13 years, where we doubled the number of people in jobs. And as a consequence of that, the share of protests that were violent picks up from the 6% back to around 30% or higher than that where it is today. And ANC support falls away very quickly. Gareth, who I mentioned earlier, said to me yesterday in Gauteng that the ANC has now lost more support in that province than what it retains at the moment. And it's going to get absolutely hammered there next year. So if you want to run South Africa successfully as a unitary state governed out of Pretoria, what you need to do is you need to take the fixed investment rate up to somewhere where it approaches our emerging market peers number. So 15 at the moment should be 25. Let's say we've got to lift it by 5+ points just to get the process started. That is something that will then deliver the jobs and on the record of the past 20 years will bring down the political temperature and stabilize the politics in either the GNU or help the ANC get back to 50+%. Now, it's easy to do this, but for as difficult as we make it, and as Mr. Ramaphosa makes it, it's easy. And at the barest minimum, these three things will get us there. Number one is burn the coal that we already have. Peak hour of a peak day, we're producing about 25,000 megawatts of electricity. To grow the economy at a rate breaking through 3% and then 4% and 5% over the next decade, we need to lift that 25,000 peak production number to 40,000. There's 20,000 megawatts of defunct coal plant lying around that can be refurbished cheaply, burn the stuff, and we generate an immediate, or within a few years, an electricity surplus. The second thing to do while we're doing that is stop taxing capital on arrival. We were discussing this outside now. You shouldn't even tax capital when it leaves your economy through estate duty and capital gains tax and the like. We tax it as it comes in through the door. So if you wish to have the privilege of investing in our economy, there are various terms and conditions. And one of these is that you give up about 30% through the gate. And that's fine. We're a sovereign state. We can do what we wish to do. But there's not much left in the sort of investor buffet that's still viable, certainly relative to what's on offer in the rest of the world. And it is this reason, as much as anything, that explains why the fixed investment rate is sitting at half. I mean, I don't know why this isn't written about more in the business press. Half of what our emerging market peers are able to produce. So we burn the coal. We stop taxing capital. Just do that on BEE if you don't want to do anything else with it. And the third thing is concession the ports and railways completely. Not this half-assed business of 2 weeks ago where maybe we'll lease a little bit of it to just the whole thing. And the airports, Rob reminded me this morning as well. So I'm still on message, Mr. Hirsov. If we, to do that, a US deal is really useful. It's the catalyst that trumps about the best thing that's ever happened to the GNU and the hope of South Africa surviving as a unitary state. Because the Americans have strategic interests here. I've aired it with Alec, and he's been good at that, Simonstown is one of 3 points that anchors control of the Indo-Pacific. It's a back door into the South Atlantic. We don't have to go through that argument in great detail. If there's a question later, we can go into it a little bit. The Americans have fallen behind China in terms of fixed investment levels into Africa. And Africa is important. It's now got more cities of 1 million inhabitants than Europe and America combined. The last great untapped global consumer market and 50 votes on global fora. But if you're an American firm, you're constrained by something called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which means you can't just sort of invest in a very undemocratic state, bribing your way in and equipping your mine with an army of child laborers because you are prosecuted in the US as a consequence. So South Africa is eminently investable from the American perspective. And the American view on the country has been, which is wholly unaired in our mainstream media, I'm sure intentionally, that look, at the moment you're a 1% growth economy with a 30% unemployment rate. That's not great to commit to. The demands, as it's put, that Trump has made of South Africa is stop taxing American firms on arrival. That's he says the Europeans are free to pay as much as they wish for the privilege of being here, but not American firms. Secure property rights properly, and just tone down the foreign policy a little bit. If America wishes to close its fixed investment gap in Africa on a relative to what it has on China, the quantum, it won't work this way in reality, but it's just interesting to think of it, the quantum of dollars it needs to put into the continent would fully close our fixed investment gap with other emerging markets. So our 15% would move to near 25%. The economy would then be growing at 4% or 5%. And what would then happen is our 30% unemployment rate would be reduced to 10% in the period of a generation. And here we get to the fork in the road, as it were. The cycle, so put into motion, saves the unitary state. The idea that South Africa is a country of provinces and it's governed out of Pretoria. It's a new country. It's only just more than 100 years old. It doesn't naturally fit together terribly well. I mean, it's just sort of assembled together haphazardly. It doesn't always have a lot in common with itself. And it's held together because at the previous great political crises, following union, 1948 and 1994, there was a powerful nationalist party with a relatively strong economy that it would have initially in office and a broad national footprint that could hold the thing together. We're now getting to a point where as the ANC fades away, and lots of things might still happen there and so on, but in the longer term, it's fading away. There isn't such a thing to replace it. And unless the unity government becomes that thing, strong, sort of slightly nationalist, reform-minded, sort of authority out of Pretoria, which is really the opposite of what we have. And either as a consequence sees the ANC go back to 50% plus or the GNU become the sort of strong institution, what's going to happen here is the unitary state will not hold. And what we're seeing, and that shouldn't frighten you too much because I'm going to explain what happens as a consequence. The unitary state doesn't hold, and the country will balkanize. It will break up. Not Ian Smith charging out saying, are we going it alone? But very much in a sort of quiet, sort of half-organic kind of de facto manner. I mean, Hermanus is really the most appropriate place to make these remarks. And this isn't a great insight or observation at all, because it's a process that we already very deeply advanced in pioneering. And the best number with which to understand that is this one, which is a bit complicated. In 1994, there were 370 people in the country for every one policeman. And today, there are 450 people in the country for every one policeman. So 370 in 94, now 450 people for every one policeman. And by chance, in 94, there were also about 370 people in the country for every one private security officer. And today, there are 100 people in the country for every one private security officer. And the definition of a modern state, why we left as man a state of anarchy and decided to live in a society governed by rules of law and laws that we subject ourselves to, is we thought that was a lot better. And in doing so, one of the things we did in explicitly and implicitly is we gave the state authority in society and therefore a monopoly on the use of force and violence. Here, the private sector has taken back that monopoly already. And if it can take that back, it can take anything back. My colleague, Becky Machlobo, produces a very interesting chart that shows road and rail freight for the country and how as the railways sort of faded and then more quickly, how the road freight industry took over. He has a similar chart that shows the breakdown rate of Eskom plant and equipment and the installation of solar rooftop that does the same thing. So every single time that we see extreme manifestations of state failure in South Africa, we're seeing macro level entry of private actors that mitigate the consequences. They don't solve the problem completely. But we're different, therefore, to other emerging markets of 30 or 40 years ago, where when they hit points of political or economic crisis, the capital and the middle capital must be parked offshore sometimes, absolutely, but that's different to fleeing, and the middle class is fleeing behind it. What's happening here instead is that South Africa's middle classes, or a far greater share of them than would otherwise be the case, are concentrating themselves in enclaves, in which can take various forms, can be a walled sort of village with a moat around it. There is one, I think, somewhere near, maybe, I don't know if it's near, it's on the Southern Cape coast that I went to once. It actually has a moat around it. And enclaves can be a series of things like an onion. So the Western Cape, in a sense, becomes a bit of an enclave, and then the Cape within it, and sort of Hermanus within that, and the like. Now, our thesis is, which will be proven right or wrong over the next 20 years, is this: the enclaves are the strength of the enclaves is inversely proportional to the extent of failure of the state. So where the state fails just a little, the enclaves do very little. Where the state fails completely, the enclaves become completely robust. And the argument, therefore, is there's a question often put to us is, well, you know, for the time being, we can sort of retreat to our golf estates and paddle courts and whatever. But doesn't there come a moment when something terrible happens? And that's even overwhelmed. And the argument is, no, that doesn't happen. Even if the politics gets really hot, the enclaves survive and remain robust. And we now have a live case study of this, which is, if you talk in Natal, is a good story to tell. And you say to your Natal audience this: imagine I stood before you 10 years ago and I told you the following. First thing I told you is you're going to run out of electricity here. For 8 hours a day, there won't be any. You'll have to make your own plan or your business will go kaput. And then I told you that just after you'd sorted that out, there'll be a plague. And you'll be locked in your home for almost 2 years. You won't be able to leave. And then I told you that there'd come floods and it would be washed into the sea. And then after that, there'll be an insurrection. And the police will abandon their posts and or join in the insurrection. And you will take to the streets, the people here sitting around you. And there was a great picture during the Natal things of I don't know, near Belito or something, of this group of slightly elderly chaps who had their shotguns that were probably they'd use for guinea fowl at the right time of the year. And they marched out to man their roadblock, and they had a piper who sort of piped them in as they and you'll have all of those things. And firstly, they tell you it cannot happen, it's completely absurd. And secondly, if it did, it's a extinction level event. There'll be nothing left. And you say to them, look out the window if you speak at sort of an office in Mshlanga. Look out the window. You did all of that. So these enclaves are solid. The sort of ideological left doesn't like this argument. It's very critical of it. And this is terrible bastions of elite outposts. But they're completely wrong. Because the enclaves are a great option for South Africa, because it means that unlike other emerging markets that might get into some deep crisis, which is then exacerbated by the flight of capital in the middle classes, that might not happen here. And South Africa will retain a significant chunk of its entrepreneurial talent and skills and capital. And if your money is temporarily offshore, it hasn't actually left. It really only leaves when you leave. And for that reason, there'll still be tax, so some more than there would have been, and there'll still be some sort of welfare net, and there'll still be some measure of employment and some measure of proper standards and things and the like. And perhaps in the fullness of time, the enclaves, if we don't, that doesn't become our permanent condition, perhaps the enclaves become the sort of nuclei of a new unitary society. And so the view from how we look at the thing is this, that if you're relatively comfortable, as in South Africa's middle classes, whatever that means, and I'm very wary of this advice, it's probably going to be not just fine but great. If the unitary state works, we're a high growth economy, it'd be a wonderful place to live. If it's not that, and you don't really have a sort of moral conscience or anything, and you don't look beyond the walls, it will be certainly, just on a material term, extremely high standard of living and quite comfortable. And a cabinet minister will be your neighbor, and undoubtedly down the road, sort of on the next fairway. And the trouble with it, and the libertarians and so on like this a lot, and it's that sort of wonderful ideal that we can aspire to, but I think they're wrong, because it's if you're poor, you your only way out now is for the unitary state to work to generate the level of growth that will bring that unemployment rate down from 10% to 30% in the generation. What in practice happens in the enclave world is we become an authoritarian society. That's what it really will be. And the most powerful actors with money or political influence or the guns will determine the hierarchy of things within society. And a lot of the world is run that way, and relative elites live comfortably in those societies, and South Africa's relative elite won't be any different to those. But the importance, therefore, of burning the coal, huge piles of it, and stopping the taxation on capital, and concessioning the ports, just three things. You mustn't be too ambitious with this administration. Is why the importance of it is it's probably the only avenue left for this generation of relatively poor South Africans to be put in a position where they might plausibly aspire to a much higher standard of living. Ale, thank you very much.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, the leader in offshore investing, connecting South Africa to opportunities worldwide. Invest better with Brenthurst.